This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Government isn't just a boys' club anymore. Women are everywhere. It's a great time to be a woman in politics. Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, me, Nancy Pelosi.
We did it!
You know, I like to tell people, you know, get on board and buckle up because my ride's going to be a big one. And if you get motion sickness, you know, put your head between your knees because Leslie Knope's stopping for no one.
That's my guest, Amy Poehler, in a scene from the pilot of the NBC series Parks and Recreation. It premiered last month. Poehler plays Leslie Knope, the deputy parks director of the fictional town of Pawnee, Indiana. Her job may be small-time and her political judgments questionable, but she sees herself as a maverick. The series is a cousin to the American version of The Office. They were co-created by Greg Daniels and are both shot in mockumentary style. But instead of office politics, Parks and Recreation is about small-town politics. Amy Poehler was a cast member of Saturday Night Live from 2001 to 2008. In her final year at SNL, she received a lot of attention for co-anchoring Weekend Update, her portrayal of Hillary Clinton, her Sarah Palin rap, and her increasingly evident pregnancy. She performed until about a week before the baby was born, and not long after started her new series. In last week's episode of Parks and Recreation, Poehler, as Leslie Knope, broke a rule by drinking wine from a gift basket while at work. In this scene, she's confessed to her boss, played by Nick Offerman. He's not impressed by her transgression.
Let's not blow this out of proportion.
I will blow this in proportion. The minimum punishment for this is an official reprimand from the city manager.
It's not that big a deal.
Maybe in your world it isn't a big deal. You're a white Protestant man with a full, rich mustache. But I am a woman, and I need to hold myself up to a higher standard.
This is ridiculous. You're punishing yourself more than anybody else is going to punish you.
No. What do you suggest we do? You think we should cover this up?
No, I'm not saying that. No one said cover up.
Good, because the cover up is worse than the crime. When you spill something and you try to wipe it up with something that's dirty, then you get double dirty.
Amy Poehler, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great to have you here. Let me ask you to describe your character on Parks and Recreation.
Well, Leslie Knope is a misguided optimist. She's kind of a person in local government who believes that things can happen really fast and big changes should happen. So she's kind of, I'll refer to her often as an open-faced sandwich. She's very easy to read and a little sloppy. She's a I really like playing her because she's she overpromises, but she's also very kind of well-intentioned and there's nothing cool about her.
One of the things I like about the character is that her ambitions are so small. Like when she gets her own subcommittee, it's like she's been elected president of the United States.
Right. Well, Leslie has a life plan. And, you know, when she explains it, it's over very small little increments. And, you know, she talks about how her next step is getting on the city council and then, you know, becoming perhaps a, you know, the right-hand man of the lieutenant governor of Indiana. And then that governor dies and then she takes over. And then, you know, after a scandal, she runs for senator. And it's just a very slow process for Leslie. And so these small little victories are low stakes but high excitement for her.
Parks and Recreation was created by Greg Daniels, who also created the American version of The Office. And there are similarities between the two shows. They're kind of companions, one set in a paper office and the other in a small town government office. But they're both in that mockumentary style. Have you watched The Office a lot? And on the whole, is it better to have seen or not seen much of The Office?
Ever since I knew that I was doing this show, I stopped watching The Office, which was hard to do because I love that show and the performers on it. But I had to stop because, well, it's hard to enjoy comedy in general right now when you're on. It's very hard to watch comedy when I'm doing a comedy show because I either watch a show and I love it and I'm jealous, or I watch a show and I see all the problems with it and I'm angry that I watched it. But that's for my shrink, not for you, Terry. I was a huge fan, and then I had to stop just because it's kind of too weird to kind of watch it at the same time.
So what has it been like for you to start a brand new show right after giving birth?
It's surreal, you know? It's been, well, certainly most people have to go back to work, you know, 6 weeks after they give birth to their kid, and they don't get craft service to make them sandwiches. So it's weird, you know? I feel very lucky to be working, and certainly I realize once you have a kid, work just kind of shifts and becomes something different, and that can be a really good thing. And, you know, really, the first six episodes that we shot are just kind of very, like, a slow motion version of me trying to lose my baby weight. They're like, and just every episode I'm trying to just shed a few more pounds. There's a lot of Spanx going on in the first couple episodes. There's a lot of undergarments and various. There's a lot of shots of me sitting in a desk.
Well, but, you know, but it's interesting. I mean, as an actor, your body is your tool. And uh-huh. When you're pregnant and after you give birth, it's kind of like a different body. So, like, your tool is like a different size and shape. So has that affected you either on Saturday Night Live when you were very, very, very pregnant uh-huh. toward the end and performing till the very last minute, or your new role on Parks and Recreation dealing with, you know, your post-labor body?
You know, it actually has been really interesting to change, for my body to be changing, because when I was really pregnant on the show, on Saturday Night Live, you know, it was difficult to write sketches because it was, when you're that big, it's kind of like wearing a sombrero in every scene. You know, you have to play the Mexican waiter in every scene because it's like, what are you not going to talk about your giant sombrero? So there was, you were limited, and I was limited in a way that could be frustrating, but was also, frankly, liberating. When I got to just kind of, you know, I kind of accepted, okay, I'm going to have to do scenes at this point where I'm hitting on guys and I'm incredibly pregnant, or, you know, when I'm rapping, I'm just going to have to kind of enjoy how big I am and how much space I take up. And it was really fun for a small person like myself to take up a lot of space.
That's interesting because you are small. You were like 5'2". You're really skinny right. When you're not pregnant. So, taking up space, different.
Yeah, different and fun and kind of, you know, it felt very, you know, it was nice for people to kind of have to get out of my way. and then it was interesting because playing Leslie Knope on the show, she's kind of, you know, she's in transition. She's trying to figure out who she is, and she doesn't pay a lot of attention to kind of how she looks, because she just really doesn't quite know how that game is played. And so there was a lot of discussion, actually, about making sure that she dressed appropriately for her town and for her budget. And having a little bit of softness, I think, helped me feel, you know, that feeling of just kind of not quite having it all tight and packaged, and that was good, but enough of that. I need to get skinny again, Terry.
So, do you miss Saturday Night Live?
I do. I mean, I think it's kind of the most exciting job I will ever have in many ways, and I certainly miss that exhilarating pace of it, but the opportunity to kind of stay in one place and play, you know, a character that grows and changes is really exciting as an actor. And SNL, there's this very, you know, it's a machine. And when you jump off the train and it speeds away and you kind of get the dust in your face and you cough and you wave goodbye to your friends and you think, oh, no, you know, there it goes. What a ride while I was on it, but I might need to... You know, I might need to walk by the side of the tracks for a while. but I do. I miss it a lot. And the people that work there are tremendous at their jobs. And so, yeah, I do.
Now, how did you get the part of doing Hillary during the primary?
Well, I think I started doing her in like 2004, 2005. I tried to do her a couple of times, and certainly it probably was just it was a process of, you know, sometimes when you're doing an impression on that show, it's just kind of because you maybe have a take on that person or you sound or look like that person. I think that I probably got the job because everyone else just wasn't paying attention that week because I certainly don't sound like her. We were similar, but in the way we look, but I didn't really have a take on her. So it took a while to figure out how to play her.
One of the sketches you did as Hillary Clinton was a debate sketch in which Obama was depicted as someone who the media really pampered and catered to. And as Hillary, you pointed that out. And then Hillary Clinton, the real Hillary Clinton, took that and ran with it, mm-hmm. basically quoted it in her stump speeches and said, look, you know, this is what Saturday Night Live is saying. And then she shortly after that appeared on Saturday Night Live in what was called like an editorial response. She basically said, I was told not to be flattered by this and that this is not an endorsement of me. Mm-hmm. And let me play the sketch that ensued after that when you and she were together on stage.
I still enjoyed that sketch a great deal because I simply adore Amy's impression of me.
Oh, well, my ears are ringing.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, well, thank you for coming. I love your outfit.
Well, I love your outfit.
Why,
but
thank you.
I do want the earrings back.
Oh, okay.
Do I really laugh like that?
Well,
makes sense.
So, how's the campaign going?
Oh, the campaign is going very well. Very, very well.
Great.
Why? What have you heard?
Nothing.
It's Hillary Clinton with my guest Amy Poehler on a sketch on Saturday Night Live. So, whose idea was it to actually invite Hillary on to respond to the debate sketch that you had done?
I'm not sure. It probably was Lorne Michaels' decision. You know, it was an exciting time because the show became a place that everybody wanted to stop by and do. And that was really exciting and interesting. And, you know, I had started on the show at September 20-something, 2001, was my first show. And it was a very difficult time to be living in New York. And also it was, you know, people were talking about how can we ever laugh again and how are we going to do comedy? And I had just turned 30 and I was starting this kind of dream job on this sketch comedy show. And
it was the first Saturday Night Live episode.
My
after
first
September
Saturday Night
11th.
Live. Yeah. Was the episode where Paul Simon was there and all the rescue workers were there. And it was a very important show at the time, certainly because New Yorkers were looking for something, you know, they were looking to laugh. And I remember those first couple of years on the show, we really couldn't do a lot of political stuff. We just, you know, it was just America didn't want to hear it. They didn't want us to make fun of Bush. The first year on that show, they really didn't. Like,
How did you know? Like, what?
The audience, the audience told you, you know, the audience kind of tells you, you really can just sense the air being sucked out of the room. You know, you just mm-hmm. can tell when an audience isn't ready for it. And for the first year or two, they wanted really big, silly characters, and they wanted to escape from the sadness that certainly we were feeling in New York and people were feeling all over the world. It was a lot of pop culture stuff those first couple years because the audience just didn't want it. You could feel anything that was the least bit sensitive really chilled the audience. And you really couldn't even make jokes about airplanes.
So did you find it a relief when you felt like you could start doing political humor again?
It was a huge relief because, you know, I had grown up watching the show and loving all the times that the show dipped into what was really happening in the political scene. And it was a great, you know, moment to be able to circle back now 7-8 years later. And for, you know, every person that was running for president, all these characters that kept coming up and us being able to play them and the audience being able to know who they were, that's a huge thing, that everyone was kind of paying attention to these people. And then so a combination of that and also just being able to talk about really kind of big issues, and it was a relief. I remember very distinctly being excited about cold opens on that show being about politics again. And it took a while.
So what was it like to be on stage with Hillary? And I should mention you were, you know, dressed identically in brown tweed jackets with black piping.
Much kudos to our wardrobe department who makes those jackets in about 45 minutes. These people are geniuses at what they do. And, you know, you'll get a call, you know, so-and-so, you know, someone's going to play Donald Trump and he has to be a vampire and this has to happen in 20 minutes. And like any live show, the people are so great because there's no – it's like an emergency room. There's no one stands in the middle of the room and starts screaming, we're never going to do this. This is never going to work. It'll never happen. We don't have enough time. It's just okay. Everyone says okay, and it gets done over and over again in the best way. But sorry, I forgot your question.
Oh, what was it like to be on stage with Hillary Clinton?
Well, it's always strange to be dressed like someone and stand next to them. That's always strange, unless you're, you know, a twin and your parents, your mother dressed you for the day. But so it was exhilarating. It was fun.
Can I point out, not everything that you did about her was flattering. So was that awkward? Making fun of her laugh, which you did on stage with her. Did you feel like, okay, I've said some things and done some things that are probably a little offensive to her, and here we are together?
Yeah, that certainly happens. You know, there would be times when I heard that that her camp were excited about something they saw, and I would say, uh-oh, be careful, because you might not be excited this week, you know? Oh, boy. You certainly have that moment where you're like, oh, boy, sorry about that. But or not sorry about that, you know, depending on what you do. But it's interesting that you point out the laugh, just because that, I think, is an example of she doesn't really laugh like that. But the perception of her laugh was interesting, that people believed that she laughed like that. She didn't. She actually has a kind of like a very inclusive and open laugh, and it's kind of warm. But that laugh came from her trying to keep things down and kind of not being able to believe all the stuff that she had to deal with. And so that's how that laugh came to be. But it really isn't anything like the way she laughs. And so it's kind of interesting too, because I don't really do a very good impression of her. So it was kind of an impression of the impression of her that was seemed to be working or seemed to be getting laughs.
I want to play another bit from Saturday Night Live. And I think this is one of the most famous things that you've ever done on the show. And this is from the night that Sarah Palin was there in person. And the premise of the sketch was that she was at the Weekend Update desk with why don't you describe the sketch? Let me let you do it.
Well, the premise was that, you know, Seth and I were sitting together and trying to think of a way to have Governor Palin on Update in an interesting way. Because she was already going to be doing something in the cold open with Tina, and she would probably be, I forget if she was in the monologue or something, but we knew that she'd be doing something. So, and it was, you know, to put things into context, it was just a few weeks before the actual election, and things were still very close. And so it was a really charged time. We had had so many political people come through the show, and the stakes were kind of high, at least we felt they were. But at the end of the day, we work in a comedy show, and so we wanted it to just be funny, just kind of straight up funny. And I said, well, it would be really fun if we just got like in a big rap battle. And then it turned into, why don't you do this, you know, really kind of hardcore rap? That would be really funny. Look at you. You're still pregnant and huge. And we started laughing about that. And so the premise became, we invited her to come do something, and at the last minute she changed her mind and decided, you know, it probably would be better for her in the campaign not to do it. And Seth kind of turns to me and says, Amy, I think you know the bit. Would you mind doing it? And I kind of pretend, oh, sure, I guess. I mean, I saw it in rehearsal. I mean, I don't know if I quite know it. And then I just break out into this really intense, hardcore rap that she was supposed to do. And it was just all these kind of, you know, jokey specifics about her campaign and all this stuff. And it was interesting because her people really, we showed them the rap before we did it. And they kind of had a few little tweaks here and there, but nothing major. They kind of were on board.
When you show them, did you show them that there would also be all these, like, background singers and dancers, and that one of them would be dressed like Todd Palin in his ski board? What is it called? What is he?
Yeah,
ski
machine?
Snowboard.
Snowboard,
yeah.
Oh,
in
yeah.
The snowboard outfit. I mean, and then there'd be, like, a moose who got shot in a drive-by. And
well, here's the thing is, you know, people forget, you know, you have to rehearse these things. So you rehearse them before you do them live. And rehearsals are always kind of awkward because people are kind of half in their costume and nobody's really committing and everyone's kind of looking at the cue cards and we're kind of going, okay, and then the Eskimos will come up, blah, 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 and then this, and the snow's going to fall and then you're going to, we'll go cut to you and you'll be having fun and blah, blah. And you sometimes you're just hoping that they won't tell you no.
Right.
But somehow we got away with it, I guess. I don't know. But it was, frankly, I kind of appreciated, you know, we had Senator McCain on as well as a host, and he, too, had a really good sense of humor about being the butt of jokes. You know, he really kind of allowed us to take on all the stuff that he was. And I think most times when people came on that show, it showed that they were game. However you felt about their politics, they were kind of showing up. And that was something, you know, you had to, you know, we wanted to walk a fine line between doing something funny and something that said something while still not abusing the host that was nice enough to kind of come on and join the show, because then you lose that way too if you come across as too intense or mean or I don't know.
So let's play that sketch, and it starts with Sarah Palin explaining that she had been asked to do a sketch and she decided it was inappropriate and she can't go through with it. So she's at the Weekend Update desk and then goes to my guest, Amy Poehler. Here it is.
Yeah, after a lot of thought, I think it might just cross the line.
Okay, well, in that case, Amy, do you want to do Governor Palin's part instead?
I guess I could give it a try. I mean,
do you want to remember it?
I kind of remember it, yeah.
Okay, why don't you try it?
1, 2, 3!
My name is Sarah Palin, you all know me. Vice President nominee of the GOP. Gonna need your vote in the next election. Can I get a what from the senior section? McCain got experience, McCain got style. But don't let him freak you out when he tries to smile, cause that smile be creepy. But when I'm VP, all the leaders in the world gonna finally meet me. You know,
Eskimos.
How you feel, Eskimos?
Ice cold.
Tell me what you feel, Eskimos.
Super
I'm
cool.
Am I alright? Cause tonight I'm the preacher. I got a bookish look and you're all hot for teacher. Time looking fine on a snow machine. So hot for each other, need a go between. In Wadilla, we just chill, baby chiller. But when I see oil, it's
drill, baby chiller.
From my porch, I can see Russia and stuff. In the house, put your hands up. All the Mavericks in the house, put your hands up. All the plumbers in the house, put your pants up. All the plumbers in the house, put your pants up.
When I say Obama, you say Ayers. Obama.
Ayers.
Obama.
Ayers.
I built me a bridge, it ain't going nowhere.
Oh.
McCain, Palin, gonna put the nail in the coffin of the media elite.
She likes red meat.
Shoot a mother humping moose 8 days of the week.
That was very primal.
Oh, every time I hear that, it is so funny. That's my guest, Amy Poehler, on Saturday Night Live doing the Sarah Palin rap. Did you write that?
I did, yeah.
Tell me what the process was like, because you've got like all the hip hop like standard lines in there, but they become all the Sarah Palin standard lines. Like,
well,
I love when I say Obama, you say Ayers.
So yeah, and I did a little Cypress Hill style on that. Ayers. It was fun because right after we decided that would be a fun bit to do, an update, I just kind of started writing some lyrics and working on it. And then when I actually started to work on the song, I got some help with the kind of, you know, Eskimos from Andy Samberg and Fred Armisen, and we kind of worked on some of that stuff together. And it was just kind of goofy. But it was fun to be really pregnant and to be leaning over a desk and shooting a moose and screaming, "You're dead because you're an animal and I'm bigger than you." It was really weird. It was like if I probably could have given birth that moment, it was like this gigantic like primal, like, "Ah!" And everyone just screamed. And it was very, it was really cathartic to be able to scream, "You're an animal and I'm bigger than you, and that's why you're dead," and just shoot a moose. It's probably the closest I'll ever get to hunting. It was that moment.
And how did it feel to be doing all of this with Sarah Palin just a few feet away, dancing in her chair, as you some really funny stuff, kind of mocking her?
Yeah, well, it was kind of honestly, I was so pregnant that I was just trying to not give birth. So I was really just trying. I was really trying to not give birth. That was my goal. So whoever was seated next to me I wasn't really paying attention to that at the time. But like maybe if I would have been more kind of aware or self-conscious about it, but.
Were you thinking of how to rhyme, "I think my water just broke," in case you needed to?
We had a lot of really funny options at the time, like that we would always joke about what I would do if I was in birth. Like, I'm trying to think, like, well, Seth and I would always make a joke that he wanted me to do a bit where I would pretend to deliver my last joke, and I would just get on the desk and I would just deliver, and he would pull a piece of paper out and it would be the last joke. But I was like, oh, this is disgusting. No. And we we had a lot of it was really fun actually during that time, because, you know, there's really nothing more exciting than doing a live show, except for maybe getting ready to have a baby, right? So the combination of checking in every day and realizing, no, I'm going to be able to be on tonight, and also during that time we did all these political specials. So during the weeks we also did these primetime political specials that were kind of long updates with various sketches. And just to be able to every day wake up and say, oh, am I going to be on TV or not tonight, it was exciting. And then just, you know, weeks after the election came. So it was all really, thrilling time to get to be doing that kind of show.
Let me play a clip from Blades of Glory. And this is a scene about champion ice skating. And you and Will Arnett, your husband, play a brother-sister ice skating duo. And your younger sister is played by Jenna Fischer. And in this scene, I should mention that you've been champions ever since your parents died in a car accident. And in this scene, you've just found out that your new opponents are a new male duo, and you really want to defeat them. You're really out to get them by any means necessary. So you're talking about that with your brother and your younger sister, played by Jenna Fischer.
Two men skating together, and in our division, no less? Why, Strons? Why is God singling us out for the greatest suffering the world has ever known?
I don't know, sis. Those two are nothing but a couple of freaks.
Yeah, and the media loves freaks.
It makes my blood boil. And all they're doing is just leeching the dignity out of our beloved sport.
You know, I'm not a violent person, but I would like to hold them down and skate over their throats.
Guys, maybe if you concentrate on the skating, people will forget all the hype, and they'll focus on the purity of the sport. and the spirit of honest competition. You guys just want to cheat again, don't you?
That's a good idea.
Much better.
Katie, please, will you just take this camcorder, okay? I don't know how to turn it on. Thank you.
No, I'm not spying for you again.
We're just asking you to discreetly tape their practice routines.
Find someone else.
What's that, Mother?
Don't.
You and Father are sad that you were killed driving Katie to her ice skating lesson all those years ago? Yeah, me too.
Remember how they used to be alive?
Papa? I can't hear you, Papa. What are you? You're crying? Still in heaven? You're still dead?
Fine, I'll do it.
Yes. Now you're playing for Team von Waldenburg.
It's the scene from Blades of Glory with my guest Amy Poehler, her husband Will Arnett, and Jenna Fischer, who's one of the stars of The Office. Great, great scene.
Thank you.
How did you and Will Arnett end up starring together in this film?
Well, it was really fun because we got to, you know, it's never really that exciting to watch people that are together in real life on screen being a couple. It's just there's something, I don't know. Sometimes it works, but often it doesn't. And so we were interested in playing a part together where we played creepy brother and sister, who are a little too close.
exactly.
Because it's creepy and, you know, it was funny. And also it was fun to play the villain, you know. I'm lucky enough to get to play a bunch of different parts. But in film, I'm not always allowed to play kind of a nasty villain. So it was really fun to play someone who was a jerk. And it's funny because, you know, they have those, they'll have testing come back. You know, they'll test these movies or they'll test shows. And I remember people saying, like, you guys are coming back and the audience is just, they just don't like these characters. And I was like, I know, because they're the villains. I know, that's the thing, is you're not supposed to like the villains. So, but that was really fun to play. And my husband is an excellent. He would like me to point out to you, Terry, that he is naturally an excellent ice skater, and I am.
Oh,
not.
Really? Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's from Canada, and you know, I think that you're kind of required to ice skate before you
come out of the womb. Yeah,
yeah. But I, a lot of my stuff was a stunt double because I was really bad.
So how did you both meet? How did you meet your husband?
We met here in New York City. We were just kind of through mutual friends and. Yeah, and I've lived here in New York since 96, and he used to come see me perform with the Upright Citizens Brigade, a group that I perform with here in New York City.
So you were together before Saturday Night Live, and before
yes,
either of you became famous.
Mm-hmm. We met before I was on the show, and then when we got married, the week after that, Will went and started Arrested Development. So we kind of were both, you know, new things were starting when we met. And we kind of been on that journey together, which has been really nice.
So did they happen to you at similar times so that one person wasn't getting far ahead of the other career-wise?
Well, you know, we talk about it all the time about how this business is the business of show is very tricky. So you have to kind of keep making sure that you feel good about the stuff you work on, and you have to feel like you keep growing and doing different things. And we both feel very blessed that we got the working experiences we've already had, you know, between SNL, and certainly now I feel that way about Parks and Recreation. And Will has such incredibly fond memories of working on Arrested Development. So it's all gravy.
Now, you've been doing improv comedy ever since you were in college.
Yeah. That was actually, you know, and it's something I could probably go on too much about. But that improv comedy was where I kind of learned all the stuff that I still do now. It was really the, you know, my comedy college. And it was where I met all of my friends in Chicago who I still work with. And it was where I learned the language of how to perform. Because when I was younger, I didn't want to do stand-up. I didn't think I'd be very good at it. And I loved watching stand-up comedy, and I grew up listening to, you know, all the famous stand-up comedians and loving their acts but not quite knowing if I could do it. And I also wanted to be an actor, and so I couldn't quite in the beginning figure out which way I wanted to go. And I was lucky enough to be able to stumble into Chicago and meet, you know, a group of people that kind of gave me you know, took me off the streets.
This was Second City?
Yeah, Second City and also Improv Olympic, which was a theater started by Del Close, a very amazing and interesting mentor who is kind of one of the more famous guys in comedy that people don't know. He taught, John Belushi and Bill Murray and Gilda. He was their teacher, and he helped start SCTV, and he helped start Second City, and he was kind of this guru, crazy, insane mentor.
Did you always have the confidence and assertiveness to be on stage in an improv situation where there was nothing to fall back on and you had to rely on your own wits and you had to have enough confidence that you weren't going to make a fool of yourself?
Well, I don't know if I always had that confidence, but I know that it always felt really exhilarating in a good way to do that kind of work. It felt like you were in control, even though you had no control over what was happening at the same time. I still improvise. I still get up on stage at Upright Citizens Brigade, which is the theater that I along with Matt Besser and Matt Walsh and Ian Roberts, we started in New York City, and now we have a theater in Los Angeles. And I still perform because that feeling of, it being a little dangerous is exciting still for me. And I think it's good as a performer just kind of keep making sure that you're not getting too comfortable. But also it's like a social thing. You know, it becomes this – it's kind of the closest thing I have to a communal religious experience where you just meet up with people that you love and you do something together and there's someone there witnessing it and hopefully, you kind of feel different after. And I think that my experiences doing improv have certainly, provided like a spirituality, I guess, in a way that maybe, I wouldn't have otherwise.
Well, it's really been a pleasure talking with you.
And, thank you. I can't believe I ended on the word spirituality. I can hear the eyes rolling in cars across America. But I'm really thrown by how deep that last part was, Terry. I really want to leave you with something that's not so deep. Well, it's too late. What am I going to do?
Well, Amy Poehler, it's been so great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Oh, it's been my pleasure, Terry. Thank you so much for having me.
Amy Poehler stars in the new NBC series Parks and Recreation. A new episode airs tonight. Irish novelist Cullum Tobin has been shortlisted twice for the Booker Prize, but critic Maureen Corrigan says that Tobin's new novel, Brooklyn, might well earn him another nomination and that the third time could be the charm. Here's her review.
It's a quandary that even the best novelists have a hard time writing their way out of. That is, how do you tell a story about a main character who's ordinary without making that character extraordinary simply because he or she is always in the novel's spotlight? Think about it. If as a reader you stick with Ishmael or Mrs. Dalloway or plain Jane Eyre long enough, you come to see them as uncommon in some way, maybe especially perceptive or plucky. But in his latest novel called Brooklyn, Cullum Tobin places his mundane heroine under some kind of magical force field that rebuffs all our desires to mistakenly read more into her. The most remarkable thing about young Eilish Lacey is that she's nothing special. While this novel, in contrast, really is something special, partly because humdrum heroines like Eilish are so scarce, and certainly because of the period atmosphere and moral complexity of Eilish's story. Tobin, who's demonstrated in previous novels like The Master and Mothers and Sons that he can render just about any subject and mood, is beautifully restrained here, up until the ending, when he delivers a sucker punch worthy of his own master, Henry James. The always suspect book jacket plot summary of Brooklyn declares that it's set in Brooklyn and Ireland in the early 1950s, when one young woman crosses the ocean to make a new life for herself. That last statement is wrong, wrong, wrong. Eilish doesn't make a new life for herself. She acquiesces to other people's plans. She drifts, and in doing so, she ultimately crashes and causes emotional wreckage. Eilish and her older sister Rose live with their widowed mother in a small village in Ireland. Because the post-World War II Irish economy is so flat, the three brothers in the family have already emigrated to England. When Rose, glamorous, a go-getter, the obvious heroine of a more obvious novel, makes the acquaintance of a visiting priest named Father Flood, she persuades him to sponsor Eilish and find her a job in Brooklyn, where his parish is located. Eilish passively goes along. Here's how Tobin deftly captures her neither fish nor fowl feelings about the new life opening up before her. Until now, Eilish had always presumed that she would live in the town all her life, as her mother had done. Now she felt that she was being singled out for something for which she was not in any way prepared. And this, despite the fear it carried with it, gave her a feeling she might experience in the days, say, before her wedding, days in which she herself was fizzy with excitement, but careful not to think too precisely about what the next few weeks would be like in case she lost her nerve. Still in a daze, Eilish finds herself in a third-class cabin on an ocean liner bound for New York. On her first night, she vomits up her dinner of peas and mutton all over that room and the hallway outside because more experienced passengers have already locked themselves into the common bathroom. Arriving in Brooklyn, Eilish is settled into a boarding house, night school classes in bookkeeping, and a job as a sales clerk at a local department store, all thanks to Father Flood again. Eilish even meets a sweet young Italian-American plumber named Tony at a parish dance. Tony wants to marry Eilish and have kids. Eilish thinks she might love him, but summoned back to Ireland because of a family tragedy, Eilish begins to feel Tony and her life in America fading like a dream. Twice throughout his novel Brooklyn, Tobin writes extended scenes in which Eilish is bobbing in the ocean, an emblematic image for a girl who allows herself to be pushed and pulled by the tides of happenstance and other people's decisions. Because he creates and sustains such an everyday character throughout this small gem of a novel, Tobin invites readers to rethink the familiar, heroic version of the Coming to America saga, in which immigrants actively seize their own destinies, along with large concepts like freedom and possibility. Eilish's muted vacillation makes for a more profound story about ordinary, limited options that also feels a lot closer to the emotional truth of the huddled masses.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Brooklyn by Cullum Tobin. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.